Lecture 19, Why Interest Rates Move Together.
Economists and economic and financial analysts frequently use the term the rate of interest as if there were but a single interest rate that described credit market conditions in the U.S. economy. I myself repeatedly did that in the previous lecture. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. A visit to the market data section of any financial website, including that of the Wall Street Journal, presents the visitor with data on scores of different interest rates. Why so many? Well, interest rates might in principle depend on who was borrowing, for how long they were borrowing, the collateral they offer, the taxability of the interest the lender will receive, and the economic conditions in place at the time. Clearly, all of those factors should matter. Less creditworthy borrowers should pay more to compensate lenders for the risk that those lenders bear. The better the collateral offered by the borrower, the lower the rate that borrower should expect to pay. It is likely that the interest rates on long maturity loans will be different than on short maturity loans for several reasons, including the fact that long maturity loans are riskier, as we will see later. And a borrower will likely pay a lower interest rate if the interest payments made by the borrower are treated by government as tax-free income to the lender. So why, in the face of all of those different interest rates, do economists speak about the rate of interest as if there were only one? There is a reason, and the reason, in a nutshell, is that there are relatively few economic factors that drive the hundreds of different interest rates that one observes in the marketplace. Because there are only a few factors, interest rates tend to move together and respond similarly to credit market conditions. In this lecture, we will investigate the factors that explain why interest rates move together. We will first take a look at some data that verify that the fact that I have my facts correct, that interest rates do move together. And then we will explore the most important factors that account for differences in interest rates, and in particular, we will understand how inflation, risk, and tax treatment affect the rate of interest. So you're asking, why is this important? It's important for many reasons, not the least of which is that understanding the determinants of interest rates will help us better understand monetary policy. What we see and hear about business conditions in the media and the risks that we face in our own lives and businesses as we plan for the future. So first, interest rates move together. Shortly, I'm going to show you a graph that shows the movement of several different interest rates between 1971 and 2010. Which rates am I going to show you? The Moody AAA rate paid by the most creditworthy corporate borrowers. The Moody BAA rate paid by less creditworthy but still quite creditworthy corporate borrowers. The 30-year fixed mortgage rate, the 6-month Treasury bill rate paid by the U.S. Treasury, and the 10-year Treasury bond rate, also paid by the U.S. Treasury. What do we see when we look in the same picture at all five of those interest rates? What we see is evidence that interest rates move together. You'll notice here that all the rates were rising from 1971 until they peaked in the early 1980s. No, they weren't lockstep. They weren't moving together exactly in a one-for-one kind of arrangement, but they all moved higher. You also see, it's very clear that starting in the early 1980s, they all trended downward together. Yes, some rates departed more from that trend line than others, but there's no doubt whatsoever that they moved together. This is evidence for the fact that all of these interest rates, while they are rates paid by very different borrowers in very different situations for very different kinds of borrowing, nevertheless seem to be marching to the tune of the same drummer. And we'll investigate the nature of that tune. Okay, so the graph shows that interest rates move together. When one is rising, they all tend to rise. When another is decreasing, all tend to decrease. But the different yields do not have the same value on different dates. Let's take a look at the stylized facts one more time for clarity. All the rates were higher in the late 70s and early 80s. All the rates have trended downward since about 1985. For most of the months shown, the six-month Treasury bill rate is the lowest of the five. For most of the months shown, the BAA rate is the highest rate of all. And in particular, and this is going to be important later, it's higher than the AAA rate. The short maturity rate, the six-month T-bill, is more volatile than any of the others. And that'll turn out to be important next time. Interest rates move together, but why? The first reason we'll take a look at is that interest rates move together because they all adjust to offset changes in the inflation rate. As we learned in an earlier lecture, markets care about the inflation-adjusted interest rate, which economists, ever since Irving Fisher, have called real rates of interest. The real rate of interest is the correct way to measure the reward to saving and the cost to borrowing. In a very real sense, the real rate of interest is the price of credit. It's the price of being able to use funds early. Suppliers of credit receive the real rate of interest, and demanders of credit pay the real rate of interest. The real rate of interest is defined as the nominal rate of interest minus the rate of inflation expected to occur over the life of the credit transaction. If I buy a one-year Treasury bond that has a yield to maturity of 7%, and if I expect the rate of inflation to be 2% in the coming year, I am predicting that my real rate of interest will turn out to be 5%, the 7% nominal rate minus the 2% inflation rate. Irving Fisher set forward a very, very important hypothesis that many studies have largely confirmed. When it's not literally true, it is generally agreed that it captures an important element of the truth. The Fisher hypothesis states that interest rates adjust percentage point for percentage point with any expected change in the rate of inflation. The intuition for this hypothesis of Irving Fisher is straightforward. Borrowers and lenders both care about the real rate of interest. If they somehow knew for sure that the rate of inflation would increase by, say, 1%, lenders would require an extra 1% increase in the interest nominal interest rate they were willing to take in order to be willing to lend. And borrowers would understand that the value of the dollars they pay back had fallen by 1%, and they would be willing to pay an additional 1% in the nominal rate of interest and borrow the same amount and undertake the same projects. Of course, Fisher's hypothesis cannot be literally true, because there are never events that lead every decision maker to agree on their predictions about the future course of inflation. There's disagreement. But there are events that occur which lead to widespread, if not perfect, agreement on the future course of inflation. When such events occur, all interest rates should move together. If the future path of inflation is expected to be lower, all interest rates should fall. If the future path of inflation is expected to be higher, all interest rates should rise. Let's put this to the test with some data. The graph plots the 10-year Treasury bond rate. It's in blue. And the consumer price index inflation rate. It's in red. Between 1954 and 2010. Okay? But it plots something else as well. The chart suggests that Fisher is correct, that changes in inflation trends cause changes in the interest rate. So let me explain. In blue, I have also plotted the trend line followed by the nominal rate of interest shown in blue. It's that very smooth curve. And I have also plotted the trend line followed by the rate of inflation. It's the very smooth line pictured in red. The trend lines, both the blue one and the red one, provide crude estimates of the expected path of each series. Presumably, borrowers and lenders might not always have foreseen the wiggles in the inflation path, but it's reasonable to believe that they would have detected and therefore foreseen the trend line in the red smooth line. That means as interest rates were rising and as inflation rates were rising, they would have been able to predict the trend in the future. And as inflation rates came down, they could predict that that trend was trending downward. What I want you to notice, and this is very, very important, is that the two trend lines are very nearly parallel lines. What's that mean? Well, it means that as inflation expectations, as modeled by the red trend line, rose between 1955 and 1980, the 10-year Treasury bond yield rose to build in compensation for that inflation. As inflation expectations fell after the initiation of the Volcker regime in the Federal Reserve in 1979, the red trend line began to fall, and the 10-year Treasury bond rate fell as well. Okay, solid evidence in favor of Irving Fisher, but there is another way to check the validity of Fisher's hypothesis, and that is by comparing the yields on inflation-protected bonds to the yields of similar bonds that do not offer inflation protection. We've already seen that TIPS, T-I-P-S, are inflation-protected treasury bonds, and we discussed these in a previous lecture. TIPS provide protection against inflation. How? The principle of a TIPS increases with inflation and decreases with deflation when that inflation and deflation are measured by the consumer price index. When a TIPS bond matures, the owner of that bond is paid an adjusted principal or the original principal, whichever is greater. And the adjusted principal is adjusted upward for changes in the consumer price index. I'm now going to show you another chart that depicts the yields on a 20-year constant maturity treasury bond with inflation protection and without it. So what do we learn by looking at the chart? We see that the non-inflation protected bond has a yield depicted in blue that for the first two-thirds of the period hovered right around 5%. It dropped then and recovered in the last quarter of the period to roughly its initial level. We see that the yield on the TIPS, the inflation protected bond, hovered slightly above 2%, spiked upwards in 2008, and then gradually began to fall. But what I really would like you to pay attention to here, what I really think is important, is that for most of the period, the difference between the inflation and non-inflation bond yields was trapped in a tight band between 2 and 3%. On average, a non-protected bond paid about 2.5% more than a TIPS bond, indicating that the market valued the inflation protection the TIP provided, but also indicating that the additional interest rate that non-protected bonds had to provide did not change very much. With one exceptional episode, the difference between non-TIP and TIP yields varied less than the yields themselves. The onset of the financial market crisis in 2008 had a very interesting impact on bond prices. It raised the price and lowered the yield on standard bonds and lowered the price and raised the yield on TIPS. That result was an unusual fall in the premium paid by non-TIPS bonds relative to TIPS bonds. Some analysts attribute this decrease to the Lehman Brothers' attempt to sell off large quantities of TIPS just before they failed as a result of the financial crisis. Others suggest that the result is due to fears of deflation, which were voiced in the latter months of 2008. Well, if those fears are what's causing that phenomenon, if deflation occurs, for example, TIPS should have the same yield as non-TIPS treasury securities of the same maturity, because the TIPS contract does not specify a reduction in the principal in the case of deflation. Remember, it pays the minimum of the inflation adjusted and the actual face value. So, one way to look at the data is that concern about deflation caused the rate on TIPS and non-TIPS securities to converge for a short period of time. The bottom line is that we have another piece of data that suggests that concerns about inflation tend to raise interest rates, and because those inflation premia are approximately constant, except in extraordinary circumstances, raise them up and down together. Higher inflation, higher interest rates. Lower inflation, lower interest rates. A second reason that interest rates move together, remember, that's what we're trying to explain. Why do economists use the term the rate of interest? A second reason that interest rates move together is because the premium that the market provides to those who lend to riskier borrowers is approximately constant over time. It's not constant, but it's not varying as much as the rates themselves vary. Okay, what's a risk premium? A risk premium is an addition to the rate of interest agreed to by borrowers and lenders that compensates the lender for the increased riskiness of a lending contract. There are several reasons why one lending contract may be riskier than another. We're going to focus on the two most important reasons. So, borrower B may be less likely to repay than borrower A, and I use B and A advisedly. one lending contract also may defer repayment for a longer period of time than another. That is, the contract may have a longer time to maturity. Both those reasons can explain differences in risk, but let's focus on the first one first. Consider first the case where borrower B is less likely to repay a loan in accordance with the terms of the loan agreement, or, if you prefer, the bond. An easy way to check for the existence of a risk premium is to compare the yields on Moody-rated BAA bonds with the yields on Moody-rated AAA bonds, because after all, Moody rates the AAA bonds as more creditworthy because those companies are more likely to repay. So again, let's take a look at some data which shows the difference. Now, I'm not showing separately the BAA and the AAA. I'm subtracting the AAA from the BAA and showing you the difference. What you see is a line that does vary. It has spikes in the 70s and in the 80s, and a huge spike at the time of the Great Contraction. It's reasonable to believe that in those three episodes, particularly, the risk was higher. Especially, it's easy to understand why risk was higher at the time of the Great Contraction. But notice that most of the time, the difference is captured in a fairly narrow band, say between 1/2 and 1 or 1.5%. In short, the risk premium moves a lot less than the various yields themselves. It moves a lot less than either the AAA or the BAA bond yields. On average, between 1971 and 2010, the risk premium associated with holding BAA rather than AAA bonds was 1.11%, with a minimum value of 0.55% and a maximum value of 3.4%. Interestingly, as I've said already, the risk premium was much higher in periods that most economists and financial analysts would describe as periods of high risk. The onset of the Arab oil boycott, the beginning of the months of Paul Volcker's term as Fed Board Chairman, and the opening months of the financial crisis that started roughly in September 2008. Note that while the risk premium rises in periods of high risk, most of the time it's captured in the range between 1/2 and 1.5%. Okay, here's a second reason why risk matters, and a second explanation of why changes in risk move many interest rates together. So let's consider two lending contracts alike in all respects, except that one has a longer maturity. What we need to understand is why longer maturity bonds are riskier. And it's going to be convenient to limit our attention to zero coupon bonds because the formulas are easier to work with. So please recall that the present value formula defines the price of a $1,000 zero coupon bond that matures M years from now, M 10, 20, whatever, to be the bond price equal to that $1,000 discounted into the present. And you'll recall that means that we have to divide that $1,000 by 1 plus R, that quantity, raised to the M power. In other words, we got to pull those dollars back into the present 1 year at a time for M successive years. And we remember also that R is defined as the yield to maturity of that bond. In fact, as we learned earlier, we infer the yield of a bond by observing it, the price of the bond, its face value, and its time to maturity. So we generally compute those yields to maturity. What risk does a Treasury bondholder face? It's not the risk that the borrower will fail to repay. since the borrower is the U.S. Treasury. At least, we hope that's not a risk. The U.S. government does have the power to tax. That's a guaranteed source of revenue, and it has never resulted in the default of a U.S. Treasury bond issue. So the risk must be of another sort, typically, at least in the data we're looking at. Treasury bond owners face the risk that interest rates will increase after the bond owners have already agreed to lend at a lower interest rate. If interest rates rise, the market value of the bonds that they've already purchased will fall, implying that they experience a capital loss on their investment. The longer the maturity, the greater the fall in that bond price. Let's take a look at a detailed example. You are looking at a table. That table gives you the change in the market price of a $1,000 bond that results from a 1 percentage point increase in the rate of interest when the rate of interest is initially 5%. Now, I manufactured these data, but I manufactured them using our old friend, the present value equation. In the first column, we are going to list several possible yields to maturity, all measured in years. 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years. Okay? Remember, initially, the price of this bond is just sufficient so that it is equivalent to a rate of return, a yield to maturity of 5%. So with one year, that's $952.38. That 5% interest rate governs that price because $952.38 grows to $1,000 in 1 year when the growth rate is 5%. If the bond is a 5-year bond, we have to start out with a smaller price, $783.53. And if it's a 30-year bond, we have to start out with a very small price, $231.38. Okay? So over 30 years, a bond for which you pay $231.38 and which grows to be $1,000 over 30 years will give you an annual rate of return, an annual growth of 5%. But now I imagine that interest rates, after you've purchased the bond, after you've paid that initial price, rise by 1%. Okay? And I calculate the new prices. And they're given in the table. For example, the price of the 1-year bond falls to $943.40. They all fall. So it's bad news for you if you've already purchased. But notice by how much they fall. If you had purchased a 1-year to maturity bond, you would have lost 1%, the last column. If you had purchased a 5-year maturity bond, you would have lost 5%. If you had purchased a 10-year maturity bond, you'd have lost 9%. A 20-year bond, 17%. If you had purchased a 30-year bond and had the misfortune to have interest rates turn against you, that is to rise by a percent, you would have lost a whopping 25%. The conclusion? Pretty straightforward. An increase of 1% in the interest rate leads to capital losses, which are larger the larger the maturity of the bond. The intuition is straightforward. When interest rates increase, both old bonds that were created earlier and new bonds that are just newly issued must offer the new competitive rate. The only way for an old bond to offer the new and higher rate is for its market price to fall. And the fall, measured as a percent, is larger the larger is the time to maturity. So, Why do interest rates move together? Why is it that economists don't feel they're doing anyone a disservice when they talk about the rate of interest? Interest rates move together because they are driven by a common component of all market rates: the price of credit at the time a bond is priced. But because bonds are not identical, their yields are not identical. However, the data strongly suggest that the part of a bond yield that can be interpreted as the risk premium or an inflation premium, those parts vary very little. They vary less than the part of the yield that we think of as the price of credit. Why is this important? Understanding that the price of credit varies with market conditions, and that such variation explains most of the variation we see over time in the thousands of interest rates that one can observe, makes bond markets and credit markets much easier to understand. There's just a substantial intuition for the working of a bond market and the behavior of bond yields. Savers rationally view different bonds as substitutes. Buying any bond allows a saver to move funds from the present into the future. Savers look for those bonds that offer the best combination of high yield and low risk. But because savers are always on the lookout for a better opportunity to store their savings, to make a financial investment, it's simply not surprising that bond yields move together. Bond yields move together for the same reason that prices of different kinds of apples move together. If the price of golden delicious apples begins to rise, many consumers will purchase red delicious apples instead, with the result that the prices of the two types of apples rise and fall together. Remember, interest rates move together because underlying interest rates is a common component: the price of credit, the price for the right to use funds earlier.